or her time, I would say as much as 50% unscheduled. Only when you have substantial slop in your schedule, unscheduled time, will you have the space to reflect on what you were doing, learn from experience, and recover from your inevitable mistakes. Manager's typical response to my argument about free time is, "That's all well and good, but there are things I have to do." Yet we waste so much time in unproductive activity, it takes an enormous effort on the part of the leader to keep free time for the truly important things. Dove, Frohman, and Robert Howard. Leadership the Hard Way. Why Leadership Can't Be Taught and How You Can Learn It Anyway. Chapter 5, The Soft Skills of Hard Leadership. 50% may seem utterly absurd to you. I surely agree it's a big stretch. Yet the overall case, Frohman, a superstar Intel exec and godfather of Israel's high-tech industry, makes is unassailable. The idea is well worth substantial consideration. And I'd say if your unscheduled number hovers around 5% or 10%, as it does for many of us, we have got a big issue and a big opportunity. Please do me the great favor of not dismissing the 50% dictum out of hand. Remember, Frohman labeled this the leader's number one soft skill. And soft skills for leaders are the all-important first 95% of their effectiveness. How about aiming for 20% and monitoring your progress and finding a coach who will beat you about the head and shoulders if you fall short? 15.3. You are your calendar. You equal your calendar. The calendar never lies. So what does your calendar say about your true priorities? You may, will very likely, be surprised, and, alas, probably not pleasantly. One's espoused priorities and one's lived priorities frequently have frighteningly close to a zero correlation. Suggestion: hold a formal weekly or monthly calendar review with yourself. And hold an informal daily review. Having a trusted advisor or coach do it with you would be preferable. You are not likely trustworthy, which is to say you are untrustworthy when it comes to self-assessment. It is axiomatic. Your calendar never lies. Your calendar always knows, do you? The way we spend our time is our priorities. The way we spend our time is our strategy. The way we spend our time is what we really care about. The way we spend our time is who we are. Obviously, there are hundreds, maybe thousands, of books on time management. My coverage here is laughably inadequate. Nonetheless, the topic must always be broached. And my goal is to remind you, in unequivocal terms, that it is no exaggeration whatsoever to say you equal your calendar, and to guess that your time allocation management process is likely to far undershoot the importance of the issue. At the end of the day, time is, not news, the only resource that really matters. Act accordingly. Indeed, that daily review is a must. 15.4.1. Meetings as primary platform for leadership excellence. Like it or not, meetings are and will be, no matter how hard you try to change things, what we leaders do. So why not make those meetings paragons of excellence rather than treating them as a necessary nuisance? Meetings equal leadership opportunity number one. By definition, most of your time equals meetings equals leadership opportunity number one. Meeting. Every meeting that does not stir the imagination and curiosity of attendees and increase bonding and cooperation and engagement and sense of worth and motivate rapid action and enhance enthusiasm is a PLO, permanently lost opportunity. Hyperbole, I strongly disagree. Why the hell shouldn't this be the goal if meetings are, as they unquestionably are, your primary leadership platform? Please pause and consider this statement. I am all in favor of eliminating unnecessary meetings, etc., etc., but fact is, you will still have a lot of meetings under any circumstance, period. 15.4.2 Meeting equals theater. A meeting is a public performance. Quarterbacking great and excellent meetings is a performing art. Thinking about a meeting as theater should inform your every twitch or utterance in terms of substance and style in equal measure throughout the course of the meeting in question. 15.4.3 A few random meetings rules. Start on time, finish on time. The boss must never be as much as 15 seconds late, even if she has to cut her boss off in the middle of a call or another meeting. Make it crystal clear that you respect others' time. Beginnings and endings overwhelm middles. Start with a bang. Finish with a bang. Never launch a meeting with something insipid like, "Let's get going." Very early on, work in a few thank yous for small things that attendees have gotten done recently. Establish a positive and appreciative tone. Make sure that 100% of attendees participate, particularly the quiet ones and the ones with frowns. Pepper the meetings with, "What do you think about this, Martin?" Immediately after the meeting, take a moment or two to question the frowners. Find out what's bugging them and attempt to deal with it, including, "Let's talk about this right now." At the close, acknowledge each person's contribution with a thanks and substantive comment. Follow up in short order with a thank you email or call or drop by that refers to the contribution the individual made. Watch your damn body language. The boss's smallest sign of distraction or boredom can be read in a flash by one and all. Blast any personally directed criticisms with a bazooka. Make to-dos crisp, short, and unequivocal. 15.4.4 Conclusion. Prepare, prepare, prepare. 1. Prepare for every meeting as if your professional life and legacy depended on it. It does. That is in no way an exaggeration. In my experience, meeting prep by bosses is contemptibly low. 2. See number 1. 3. A meeting is a performance. 4. Meeting excellence is not an oxymoron. Note. This far too brief discussion is in no way about quote-unquote running better meetings, unquote. It is about a 180-degree reconception of meetings as premier platforms for the exhibition of leadership excellence. 15.5 The Rule of One. If there is any one secret to effectiveness, it is concentration. Effective executives do first things first, and they do one thing at a time. Peter Drucker. Strong language. Just one secret to effectiveness, Mr. Drucker asserts. Wow. And, indeed, few things make me laugh harder than a unit plan featuring, quote, our 6, or for that matter, 3 or 4 or 5, strategic initiatives for 2018, unquote. Fat chance. The byproduct of initiative-itis is confusion, frustration, lost credibility, demoralization, and, ultimately and inevitably, failure. That is, 3 hearty cheers, as usual, for Mr. Drucker. 15.6.1 Allies 1 The Rule of 80 The Leader's Guide to Getting Things Done. Spend 80% of your time finding and developing and nurturing allies of every size and shape in every nook and cranny, especially the out-of-the-way nooks and crannies of the organization. Aiming to accomplish something new and different that goes against the grain, getting blowback from the powers that be, trying to figure out how to win over those who are putting up roadblocks, there is actually a simple answer. Forget about opponents. Absolutely, positively forget about them. Don't waste precious time or emotional energy trying to remove barriers and win over those who disagree. Instead, Search far and wide for people who buy your act. Spend virtually all your time, indeed approximately 80%, seeking out and building a base of allies. Then spend more gobs and gobs and gobs of time nurturing your allies. Then urge your allies to spend the lion's share of their time finding even more allies. Nurture above is a huge word. Never, ever, 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 ever take an ally for granted. It is a common as dirt strategic error. That is, you assume your allies are on board when in fact they are often facing blowback themselves and need constant encouragement. Perhaps spend half of your allies' time, 50% of that 80%, on nurturing. Bottom line, losers focus on, waste inordinate amounts of time and emotional energy on, enemies. Winners focus on allies, allies, and more allies. Losers focus on removing roadblocks. Winners avoid roadblocks and focus on small wins that are positive demos of the new way. Losers make enemies. Winners make friends. Losers focus on negatives. Winners focus on positives. Losers stick out like a sore thumb. Winners work via allies and are largely invisible. Leaders getting things done, message number one. Allies, 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 more allies. This is personal. The program I developed at McKinsey that led to In Search of Excellence and, according to the book The Firm, resulted in no less than the rebranding of the firm, flew directly in the face of McKinsey's core beliefs, strategy first, people, culture, a distant second. Hence, my de facto enemies were the fabled organization's power players, and I was definitely not a power player. My eventually successful strategy was to sidestep the bad guys and recruit allies. In the spirit of the suggestion here, ally recruitment and maintenance absorbed the lion's share, indeed about 80%, of my time over the entire 4 years I was involved in the Excellence Project. 15.6.2. Allies 2. Suck down for success. Loser. He's such a suck up. Winner. He's such a suck down. In the saga reported in Charlie Wilson's War, CIA mid-level staffer Gus Avracados made miracles happen far above his pay grade. Author George Kreil put it this way. He had become something of a legend with the people who manned the underbelly of the agency. Gust knew every top-floor CIA executive secretary by name and had helped many of them sort out personal or professional problems. The folks in the mailroom, this was over 30 years ago, and in the bowels of computer operations were also subject to Gust's intense and personal attentions. In effect, you could say that Gus Avracados was commander-in-chief of the invisible 95% of the agency, which allowed him to make extraordinary things happen despite furious resistance from his bosses and bosses' bosses sitting atop a very rigid organization. Translation, suck down for success. Want to get help in a flash with this or that or the other in finance or purchasing or marketing? If you have a fabulous and encompassing network down below, the waters will, almost literally, part. Message. Down is where the real work is done. Invest like a maniac in down. FYI, most don't get this, which is why it is a particularly valuable strategy. 15.6.3. Allies 3. The Getting Things Done Implementation Axioms. The shortest distance between two points is never a straight line. Implementation is a messy process. Implementation is an emotional process. Logic plays no more than a bit part. Implementation is a 24/7 political process. Revel in the mess, revel in the politics, or forget about getting difficult and/or controversial things done. 15.7.1. Dispense enthusiasm. I am a dispenser of enthusiasm. Ben Zander, symphony conductor and management guru. Sanders' quote readily translates into a significant leadership requirement: dispense enthusiasm. Amen. But there's also a subtle point. Mr. Sanders' primary trade is as a symphony conductor. I've had the privilege of watching him perform. At first blush, at least to a musical amateur like me, a piece of music is a piece of music, a score is a score. The parameters are locked in. Moreover, musicians either know their stuff or they don't. Of course, that's utter nonsense. A magical presentation of a favorite symphonic piece stirs your heart because of the emotion and power it transmits in the particular performance you saw. For example, a 2016 visit to the Symphony Hall in Boston. I've always loved Bach's Goldberg Variations, but that night's performance took me to the moon. Being, quote-unquote, taken to the moon is where the conductor's dispensing enthusiasm part comes in. Call it the last 90% of the quality of the performance. That's probably a pretty accurate number. All this translates one for one into leadership in the first grade classroom, the 9-person training department, and the 11-person project team. The leader's enthusiasm and her skill at dispensing enthusiasm is the great leadership differentiator. Hard research on education supports this. One major study concluded that pedagogic approach, lecture, small group engagement, and the like, had effectively no impact on the student's post-course learning and engagement with the subject matter. What made all the difference was the teacher's passion for the material. 15.7.2. Enthusiasm, the showmanship mandate. It's always showtime. David D'Alessandro, Career Warfare. Keywords of equal importance. Showtime, always. The old saws that effective leaders model the way or walk the talk are 100% accurate. For example, leaders must live, moment to moment, the desired culture. And moment to moment means just that. The day-to-day stuff and the big stuff matter far less than the micro embodiments of the way we do things around here. For example, the boss's 30-second exchange with Jane or Jack in the hall on the way out of the meeting. Leaders are showmen or showwomen. All leaders are showmen or showwomen. All leaders are showmen or showwomen all the time. All equals all. No option, never off stage. To restate a critical point made earlier, showwoman, showman does not mean loud or extroverted or surely long-winded. For leaders, it's always showtime and always has been. It had been a scene that those in the room would long remember. Washington had performed his role to perfection. It was not enough that a leader looked the part. By Washington's rules, he must know how to act it with self-command and precision. John Adams would later describe Washington approvingly as one of the great actors of the age. David McCullough in 1776. When the situation in Boston during the early days of the Revolutionary War was most dire, Washington convinced the British through a studied demeanor, a carefully constructed tableau which made the headquarters look grand and his army hale and hearty and well-equipped, that the Americans were a formidable force to be reckoned with. Yes, it's always showtime. Thee, me, George Washington. 15.7.3. Hire for enthusiasm. Enthusiasm. Hire for it, promote for it, reward it. Be explicit. 15.7.4. Enthusiasm. Get the week off to a rousing start. Next Monday, script your first 5 or 10 plays. That is, carefully launch every week in a purposeful fashion. NFL coaches carefully script the first few plays of a game, aiming to get off to a good start. Of course, the details of the plan will likely fall through long before play number 10, but the script aims to set the course. Beginnings are everything. A solid research finding, not a slogan. So start the week off on the right foot. Do not, come hell and high water, let the first 45 minutes of the week slip by without decisive impact. A week is a precious unit of measure, and a week is a story, a novella. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Sweating big time on the beginning is crucial to all that follows. 15.8. Body language. The 5X rule and more. Research indicates the pitch, volume, and pace of your voice affect what people think you said about 5 times as much as the actual words you used. Deborah Grunfeld, Stanford Business, Spring 2012. In the election of 1994, Mandela's smile was the campaign. That smiling, iconic campaign poster. On billboards, on highways, on street lamps, at tea shops, and fruit stalls. It told black voters that he would be their champion, and white voters that he would be their protector. It was the smile of the proverb, tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner. To understand is to forgive all. It was political Prozac for a nervous electorate. Richard Stengel, Mandela's Way, 15 Lessons on Life, Love, and Courage. As I exited a crowded plane after a 5-hour flight, I asked the flight attendant how many people bothered to say thank you as they walked past her on the way out. Her response took me, the professional thank you fanatic, by surprise. The thank you doesn't really matter, she said. What matters is a smile and eye contact. One more time, body language takes first prize. The smiling airplane passenger is hardly equivalent to the enormity of the Mandela commentary. On the other hand, it is a marvelous example of the importance of body language in ordinary daily transactions, professional or personal. Look one more time at the number at the top of this section. 5X, 5 times more. This is serious business. Become a formal student of body language. Little is more important. Good news. There is a truckload of hard research and guidance on the application thereof, available to aid and abet your effort. Note, study, practice. I frequently use some variant on the term above, become a formal student of. The reason is that when the talk turns to the likes of body language, I would not be surprised if you took the idea seriously. But experience suggests that your response will in practice be, good idea, I'll pay more attention to that. Fine and dandy, and a hopelessly inadequate response. The point is that topics like this are subject to formal study. They are marked by significant research verification. I am not asking you to pay more attention to, for example, body language. I am asking you to become a formal student of body language, much as you would if the topic was biochemistry, rose gardening, or taking up the flute. 15.9. Loving leading, or not. I had left out one big thing. Tom, it was a fine speech, but you left out the most important thing. Leaders enjoy leading. I'd given a speech in Dublin titled The Leadership 50. Afterward, and over a Guinness, of course, the head of a sizable marketing services firm made the above remark about what I had omitted. As I reflected, I agreed he was right. Simply put, some people get off on the people and politics puzzles and the inherent messiness of human affairs that are at the heart of effective leadership. Some don't. Leading is its own thing, and that thing may or may not be your thing. Think long and hard about this. This applies to a 4-week assignment as a project leader of a 4-person team as much as it does to a big job. Obviously, the hope of authors like me, you can learn a thing or two here that will abet your leadership skills, and you may well find that you increasingly enjoy the job. That was the mini-tale in Chapter 5 about the limited Les Wexner coming to take pleasure in the people development aspect of his enterprise. Still, at some point, and I've seen it by now a dozen times, it may become clear that this people and politics stuff just isn't for you for whatever reasons, at which juncture it may be wise to turn to something else. 15.10. Every day is a startup. The rule of zero. Every year for 25 years is a startup. For that matter, every event we produce is a startup. When the doors open, our reputation is left outside. We start with not one single satisfied customer. I take nothing for granted. Jose Celibe Neto, HSM Group. I have worked with my Brazilian colleague, JSN, for 30 years. This truly is his attitude, and I judge key number one to his sustained success. He does indeed take nothing for granted, ever. 15.11. The Rule of 10. Every day brings at least 10 leadership opportunities for every one of us. Leadership is not limited to formal roles. While we all know that, it doesn't hurt to offer a reminder. Simply put, every day offers up a plethora of leadership opportunities. When you are busy beyond measure, but take a half an hour, or even 15 minutes, to help someone who is also up against a crushing deadline, well, that's leadership of the first order. The bigger idea is to instill and reinforce the idea of leaders all the time into everyone in your organization. 10 sample leadership acts for non-bosses. Bring good spirits to work, especially, say, on a rainy day. This is number one on the list for good reason. Our attitude is ours to choose. Busy as hell? Take 10 minutes and help someone with a dreary task. Listen intently, fiercely, see chapter 13, when someone is talking to you. Don't interrupt. Repeat. Listen intently when someone is talking to you. Don't interrupt. Thank someone for being helpful with a tiny task. Chat up someone in another function with whom you accidentally cross paths. 3 to 5 minutes is fine. Take a new hire or two-day temp out for coffee. Volunteer for a crappy little task. Read an intriguing industry blog post. Discuss it with one or two people. When you're heading out the door for home, stop for a moment and chat with someone about the day. Point to a positive. This list is directly inspired by Betsy Meyer's exceptional book, Take the Lead. Motivate, inspire, and bring out the best in yourself and everyone around you. Key message, as here. Leadership is everybody's business. 15.12, leading. Relationships come first. ROIR, return on investment in relationships, tops ROI, return on investment. The capacity to develop close and enduring relationships is the mark of a leader. Unfortunately, many leaders of major companies believe their job is to create the strategy, organization structure, and organizational processes. Then they just delegate the work to be done, remaining aloof from the people doing the work. Bill George, Authentic Leadership. Bill George, former CEO of Medtronic, makes a profound, or is it tragic, point here. It is, in a way, the subtext of this book. Hard is soft, soft is hard. Leaders view their jobs in terms of the mechanics, strategy, processes, and so on, and shortchange the devilish people bit. Or, as Mr. George suggests here, assign it to others. Dealing with this roadblock to leader success has preoccupied me for 5 decades. Allied commands depend on mutual confidence. This confidence is gained, above all, through the development of friendships. General Dwight D. Eisenhower, from the magazine Armchair General, which offers leadership secrets from the most renowned officers. Armchair General reports, perhaps Eisenhower's most outstanding ability at West Point was the ease with which he made friends and earned the trust of fellow cadets who came from widely varied backgrounds. It was a quality that would pay great dividends during his future coalition command. General Eisenhower was the architect and builder of the D-Day landing and subsequent campaign that brought World War II in Europe to an end. Dealing successfully with the likes of prickly personalities such as Roosevelt, Churchill, de Gaulle, Patton, and Montgomery, was arguably key number one. It required unimaginable interpersonal skill and, frankly, was far more important than effective strategic planning. Systematically improve your ROIR. Track and manage your investments in relationships and your relationships portfolio as closely as you would track and manage budget numbers. What precisely is this week's relationship investment plan? This is the ball game, per the Bill George and Dwight D. Eisenhower comments above. This is not a catch-as-catch-can topic. Speed is all, not. New tech tools allow us to cast a much wider net than ever before, which is invaluable in many ways. But relative to this discussion, speed is not the key to the most valuable relationships. Quite the contrary. Yes, it's 2018, and yes, the world is spinning, spinning, spinning faster and faster every day. But return to Bill George. Getting things done that matter require friends and colleagues you can trust and who routinely throw themselves in front of the train for you. Accumulating and maintaining a rich network of such friends is a matter of time. That is, a time-consuming investment. Great network equals significant time investment equals no shortcuts. 15.13.1 Acknowledgement. The deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated. William James. In his classic How to Win Friends and Influence People, author and self-improvement icon Dale Carnegie offers the above quote and urges us to pay careful attention to James's word choice. Craving, not merely wish or desire or longing. The desire for acknowledgement is universal and runs as deep can be. Employees who don't feel significant rarely make significant contributions. Mark Sanborn, sales training guru. Yes, it is a clever quote, but I sincerely hope that you will see it as much more. A profound statement of surpassing importance to leaders. Making your team members feel that what they do matters, that is, feel significant, is a worthy candidate for leader job one. While giving acknowledgement is a most desirable human trait, I'd add that it is also a first-class profit and growth booster. Customer engagement is a direct product of employee engagement, and, it should go without saying, fat chance, those who feel significant are far more likely to go the extra mile or nine for their teammates and for their customers. Number one, no exaggeration. Acknowledge is perhaps the most powerful word in the leadership lexicon. Strong language. I have observed the power of acknowledgement 100 times, 100 times, in any damn context you can name, in any damn culture you can name. It matters. It works. Acknowledgement. Me equals center of the universe. When I left the dining room after sitting next to Gladstone, I thought he was the cleverest man in England. But when I sat next to Disraeli, I left feeling I was the cleverest person. Jenny Jerome, Winston Churchill's American mother. When you are talking to Bill Clinton, you feel like he doesn't care about anything or anybody else around but you. He makes you feel like the most important person in the room. Mark Hughes, screenwriter, Forbes blogger. Is this an inherent trait or a developable skill? I contend it is both. Some may have more of a proclivity than others for making you or me feel the center of things, but recall that I believe that becoming a listening professional is indeed a learnable skill, albeit one that takes time and practice, practice, practice. 15.13.2 Acknowledgement, W-D-Y-T. The four most important words in any organization are, what do you think? Courtesy Dave Wheeler, posted at tompeters.com. W-D-Y-T. First, it is acknowledgement of the fact that I am worth listening to, a grand certification of my worth. Also, not so incidentally, the collective WDYT answers provide a Niagara Falls of good ideas. Suggestion: count your daily WDYTs. Start today. Call it the engineer still in me, but you truly can measure things like this. 15.14.1. The 30K rule. So easy to do. So why don't we do it more often? That is, say thank you. CEO Doug Conant sent 30,000 handwritten thank you notes to employees during the 10 years he ran Campbell Soup, Bloomberg Businessweek. That amounts to approximately 12 thank you notes every weekday for 10 years. Egads. And you? Thank you. Why the hell does it seem to be so damn difficult for so many people, including many or most leaders, to utter these two words? That thank you deficiency for me is one of life's greatest mysteries. I have many, many things to thank my mother for, including love. But near the top of the list, perhaps second right after love, was her insistence, and she was an all-star at insisting, that the words thank you be used on a very regular basis. That insistence has not just served me well, it has made all the difference. At this point, I could regale you with a dozen anecdotes I've gathered over the years testifying to the staggering power of a simple thank you. This one is typical. A woman I chatted with at one of my seminars had interviewed for a mid-level managerial job and subsequently wrote a note thanking the interviewer for his time and consideration. She was the only one of 30-some candidates who did so. She got the job. And the interviewer later told her that there were several qualified candidates, but the thank you note was the factor that had tipped the scales. There are many more like vignettes, but suffice it to say that most are hard to believe. Such a simple gesture, such a disproportionate response. Even Twitter. I'm a regular Twitter user. Some number of people retweet this or that remark that I made. Not a big deal. As a matter of course, I often as not write thank you in response. Often as not, my thank you results in a line or two or three response saying that it was great that I said thank you. And I bet that on 100 of those thank you for the thank you occasions, the response was along the lines of, thank you for bothering to say thank you. Bother is a big word, acknowledging that I went out of my way to take the time to say thank you. Yes, even Twitter. 15.14.2. Thank you. Little beats big. It's not the thank you for making the $1 million sale that matters. Praise for that's going to happen regardless. It is, to use Ken Blanchard's the one-minute manager phrase, catching someone doing something, some little thing, right. To the recipient, the spontaneous kudo for the little ones has higher impact than the biggies. It means that the boss or peer noticed the wee gesture. You have made the recipient, recall the earlier quote, feel significant. Significant equals big word. 15.15.1. Civility, courtesy. From a Twitter conversation on civility. Tim Brander. Internal courtesy sets the tone for external relationships. Oh my, is that ever true? Dave Wheeler. MBMR. Management by Mom's Rules. Good home training applied can be a performance multiplier and persona differentiator. Sonny Bindra. You're not running late. You're rude and selfish. More, not from Twitter. MRI means most respectful interpretation of what someone's saying to you. I don't need everyone to be best friends, but I need to have a team with MRI. So you can say anything to anyone as long as you say it in the right way. Maybe you need to practice with, can you help me understand why you don't want to do this or why you wanted to do that? I just make it so it's a human environment. Robin Domeniconi, CMO, Rulala, a flash sale website. From Adam Bryant, Quick and Nimble, lessons from leading CEOs on how to create a culture of innovation. Civility is a good human strategy and an excellent bottom line strategy. Simply put, there is no item discussed in this book that would not be 10 times easier to implement in an enterprise where unwavering civility was a keystone of the organizational culture. 15.15.2. Civility. Caring. The one piece of advice which will contribute to making you a better leader, will provide you with greater happiness, and will advance your career more than any other advice, and it doesn't call for a special personality or a certain chemistry, and anyone can do it, and it's this. You must care. General Melvin Zeis. This excerpt is from a National War College address by General Zeis to mid-level officers. I once gave the annual Forrestal lecture at the U.S. Naval Academy. I handed out, on my own nickel, 4,000 copies, CDs, ye oldie days, of the Zeis speech that featured this quote. I thought it was that important. 15.15.3. Civility. K equals R equals P. Kindness equals repeat business equals profit. K equals R equals P. Kindness to patients is kind and cost effective. There is a misconception that supportive interactions require more staff or more time and are therefore more costly. Although labor costs are a substantial part of any hospital budget, the interactions themselves add nothing to the budget. Kindness is free. Listening to patients or answering their questions costs nothing. It can be argued that negative interactions, alienating patients, being non-responsive to their needs, or limiting their sense of control, can be very costly. Angry, frustrated, or frightened patients may be combative, withdrawn, and less cooperative, requiring far more time than it would have taken to interact with them initially in a positive way. Joanne L. Earp, Elizabeth A. French, Melissa B. Gilkey, Patient Advocacy for Healthcare Quality, Strategies for Achieving Patient-Centered Care. Regarding kindness and its impact, Prestani Associates is the premier source of hospital patient satisfaction measures. One study included 139,380 patients from 225 hospitals. Remarkably, none of the top 15 factors determining patient satisfaction referred to the patient's health outcome. Instead, patient satisfaction was effectively determined by the quality of patient-staff interactions and the way patients observed staff members behaving toward one another. Based on Putting Patients First by Susan Frampton, Laura Gilpin, Patrick Charmel. Hospital patient count is shown to be directly related to patient satisfaction evaluations. Hence, kindness, not to minimize the spiritual value thereof, has a positive impact on hospital revenue and profitability as well. Kindness. Kind, thoughtful, engaged, listening, appreciative, open, honest, responsive, profitable. Kindness equals soft, never, never, never. 15.15.4. Civility versus speed. Civility and speed can often be at odds. If relationships are everything, and they are, then civility beats speed. The speed is everything crowd has a good point, but so does, equally, the civility is everything crowd. Think about this. Do not be conned by the speed is all adherents, including, historically, me. Read, study. Little is greater than big. Civility, kindness. The Manager's Book of Decencies, How Small Gestures Build Great Companies, by Steve Harrison. The Power of Small, Why Little Things Make All the Difference, by Linda Kaplan Thaler and Robin Koval. The Power of Nice, How to Conquer the Business World with Kindness by Linda Kaplan Thaler and Robin Koval. 15.16. Helping. What Leaders Do for a Living. An Art and Science to be Mastered. What do leaders do for a living? They help. Aid and abet their team members' pursuit of personal, professional, and organizational goals, right? Next question. How many of us could say we are professionals at helping? Meaning that we have studied and mastered, like a professional mastering her musical craft, helping. My experience says damn few merit the professional at helping designation. Helping is one of those things. Helping, sure, I know how to help people. What's the big deal? What's so complicated? Helping. One, helping is a big deal. In fact, a very big deal. Two, most of us are rank amateurs when it comes to effectively helping. Three, in my opinion, true excellence in helping is much more delicate than neurosurgery. I believe that with heart, head, and soul. Pure Genius. Helping. How to Offer, Give, and Receive Help by Ed Schein. MIT Professor Ed Schein is the acknowledged master on this topic. Relative to the discussion here, his book demonstrates that you can treat helping as a standalone topic that can be subject to scientific study. Helping. Last chapter. Some key principles. Effective help occurs when the helping relationship is perceived to be equitable, full partners in moving forward. Everything you say or do is an intervention that determines the future of the relationship. Everything equals everything. Small is greater than big. Effective helping begins with pure inquiry. Questions, not prescriptions, first. See also Schein's book, Humble Inquiry, The Gentle Art of Asking Rather Than Telling. It is the client who owns the problem. Words matter. For example, client. There's a quote in helping from a National Football League player turned lawyer turned professional football coach. He calls his players my clients. Think twice or thrice on this. Football player as the coach's client. Nice. Summary. Helping is what we, leaders, do for a living. Employee as client. Study, practice helping as you would neurosurgery. Helping is your neurosurgery. Obviously, I have no more than scratched the surface. My goal is simply to raise the level of attention to this topic. I do hope I have adequately demonstrated that this is indeed what leaders do for a living, and that it is supremely difficult to do it well. The good news, it is a topic that can be dissected and an area in which we can improve through assiduous study and practice. The parallels with listening professional in Chapter 13 are almost exact. 15.17. Read. CEO failing number one. If I had to pick one failing of CEOs, it's that they don't read enough. The co-founder of one of the world's largest investment companies to the author. The conversation was a casual one. This and that. Out of the blue, my dinner companion said, "Do you know what's the number one shortcoming of CEOs?" I made a smart-aleck response along the lines of, "Well, I can think of 10 major shortcomings, but no, clue me in on number one." The response he gave, see immediately above, could have knocked me over with the proverbial feather. As I subsequently thought about it, it made more and more sense. Recall the quote by physicist Albert Bartlett. The greatest shortcoming of the human race is our inability to understand the exponential function. We are all under the gun. Keeping up is nigh on impossible. But one must try. Age 21, last year's university graduate, or age 75, me. And the best weapon in 2018, read, read, read. Note, the above exchange took place at a private party, and it is inappropriate to name my dinner companion. It was not Warren Buffett. But speaking of Buffett, in my whole life I have known no wise people over a broad subject matter area who didn't read all the time. None. Zero. You'd be amazed at how much Warren reads and how much I read. Charlie Munger, Vice Chairman, Berkshire Hathaway. Munger is Buffett's number two. Read. 15.18.1. Wait. Rarely does a book have the personal impact of Wait, The Art and Science of Delay by Frank Partnoy. Speed, speed, speed is the plea by me and pretty much everyone else, and the times surely are a-changing. Yet Mr. Partnoy, in a thoroughly researched book, persuasively argues that to slow down and think about it is the very definition of what it means to be human. Consider, from Wait. Thinking about the role of delay is a profound and fundamental part of being human. The amount of time we take to reflect on decisions will define who we are. Is our mission simply to be another animal, or are we here for something more? Life might be a race against time, but it is enriched when we rise above our instincts and stop the clock to process and understand what we are doing and why. Computer programmer, investor, writer, painter Paul Graham wrote, "The most impressive people I know are all terrible procrastinators." No commandments from me will be forthcoming. I am simply suggesting that you take a deep breath, yes, that's permissible in 2018, and reflect on this idea and seriously consider reading Partnoy's book. 15.18.2. Wait and Excellence, First Order Partners. Here's where I come out on the topic of waiting. The day patience dies is the day that excellence disappears. Achieving excellence is by definition a painstaking process. While the times require extreme urgency, peerless quality of work will always demand care and thoughtfulness, which by definition cannot to any significant extent be rushed. In fact, it is precisely such peerless quality of work and care that animate this entire book. Excellence in all we do is by far the most and perhaps the only effective response to the coming technology maelstrom. 15.19.1. Effective self-management. Leader virtue number one. Being aware of yourself and how you affect everyone around you is what distinguishes a superior leader. E.D. Seashore. E.D. Seashore knew few, if any, peers in the world of organizational development. Her assertion here is a strong one. When it comes to effective leadership, self-knowledge is the number one distinguishing trait. In her excellent book, Take the Lead, Motivate, Inspire, and Bring Out the Best in Yourself and Everyone Around You, Betsy Myers echoes Seashore. Leadership is self-knowledge. Successful leaders are those who are conscious about their behavior and the impact it has on the people around them. They are willing to examine what behaviors of their own may be getting in the way. The toughest person you will ever lead is yourself. We can't effectively lead others unless we can lead ourselves. 15.19.2. Self-management problem number one, misperception. In The New Leaders, Daniel Goleman, the EQ guru, and his colleagues get to the heart of the matter. Leaders' self-perception stinks, and the smell gets worse as one climbs the hierarchy steps. How can a high-level leader like blank, Goldman does not provide the name, be so out of touch with the truth about himself? It's more common than you would imagine. In fact, the higher up the ladder a leader climbs, the less accurate his self-assessment is likely to be. The problem is an acute lack of feedback, especially on people issues. This quote is consistent with a very substantial body of research on leaders' misperceptions in general. In one quantitative study, for example, the researcher counted the number of times a leader interrupted others in the course of a typical meeting and the number of times the leader himself was interrupted. I'm sure you can imagine the results. The leader felt that he had rarely interrupted, but that he had frequently been interrupted. The data unequivocally say the reverse. To a degree, nearly an order of magnitude that would be laughable were the topic in fact not so serious. 15.19.3 Self-Awareness, Voices of the Masters. Ben Franklin. There are three things that are extremely hard: steel, a diamond, and to know oneself. Dale Carnegie. The biggest problem I shall ever face. The management of Dale Carnegie. I'm afraid I've never been keen on self-reflection. Just get on with it is more or less my motto. Yet virtually all, if not all, of the top leadership thinkers, and the likes of Ben Franklin and Dale Carnegie, are clear that self-knowledge, leading ourselves, per Betsy Myers, is an imperative for effective leadership. Who am I to disagree? 15.20 Leaders, and the rest of us, beware. Your judgment, well, stinks. The first principle is that you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. Richard Feynman. Psychologist Daniel Kahneman was awarded the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences in 2002 for his studies of cognitive biases. He and his colleague, the late Amos Tversky, began their study of errors in human judgment in 1973 at Tel Aviv University. The work the two produced is encyclopedic and of the most profound importance. In 2011, Kahneman produced his Summa, Thinking, Fast and Slow. It is effectively a chastening 499-page catalog of the errors we make in judgment. Our use of intuition comes in for a particularly severe drubbing. In a word or three, our intuition, thinking fast, by and large stinks. Though, truth be known, slowing down our thought processes also results in its own flavors of errors. Kahneman summarizes in his introduction, my aim for water cooler conversations regarding the book. Improve the ability to identify and understand errors of judgment and choice in others and eventually in ourselves, by providing a richer and more precise language to discuss them. In at least some cases, an accurate diagnosis of our biases may suggest an intervention to limit the damage that bad judgments and choices often cause. Bottom line. Cognitive biases cloud every decision and judgment we make. Awareness is not the answer, but it at least helps. In the face of our limited cognitive processing skills, I am hardly endorsing paralysis. We must move forward. I am, however, urging study, reflection, and awareness. How often is our judgment twisted by cognitive biases? 100% of the time. Not a joke line, not a rounding error. Read. Study. I surely don't imagine that you will read all these. The goal is simply to offer you a certified, by me, sampler. Thinking, Fast and Slow is a must, as is The Invisible Gorilla, about one of the most famous socio-psychological experiments in recent decades, in which the majority of observers did not see a gorilla walk in front of them because of a simple distraction created by the researchers. Thinking, Fast and Slow, by Daniel Kahneman. Mistakes were made, but not by me. Why we justify foolish beliefs, bad decisions, and hurtful acts. By Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson. The Invisible Gorilla and Other Ways Our Intuitions Deceive Us. By Christopher Chabris and Daniel Simons. Why We Make Mistakes. How we look without seeing, forget things in seconds, and are all pretty sure we are way above average. By Joseph Hallinan. Everything is Obvious, How Common Sense Fails Us, by Duncan Watts. The Drunkard's Walk, How Randomness Rules Our Lives, by Leonard Mlodinow. Fooled by Randomness, The Hidden Role of Chance in Life and in the Markets by Nassim